Okay, today is January 25th, we're taping Jewish Public Policy. We're still in the introduction section, which is, what is Jewish public policy? What's the purpose of our, the way we frame public policy? We frame what should be followed by everybody in order to make society work. Socrates claims in the Republic that everybody should behave in a way whereby they acknowledge that if everybody would do this, society can get by. You say, well, everyone is honest, but I'm going to cheat. Society can handle just me cheating, right? Surely everyone would agree it can't handle everybody cheating, right? So if that's true, then you shouldn't do it. Okay? All right, that's pretty orderly. Okay. In other words, according to that approach, cheating is only wrong because society can't handle everybody cheating. Nothing to do with that. Socrates wasn't interested in perfecting individuals. Right? He's considered by Western thought to be as perfect as an individual as could be, although he was a profound pedophile and in the middle of his dialogues, he's always calling a young boy to go, all right, I've had enough of this. He calls a 12-year-old boy to go out with him and do whatever he has to do with him. So to the Greeks, that was perfectly fine. They didn't even excise that from the dialogues, right? But still, I digress. Socrates claims that we're not interested in a perfect individual because he doesn't have a system that claims, come on, neither does Aristotle, that we are created in an image of an all-knowing and all-powerful being. Right? Aristotle did believe in a powerful being that created the universe, but he stops there in terms of a personal relationship. We have no bearing on that. We may be worth our while to offer some sacrifice to that person, that being, or to keep that being happy with what we're doing, right? But there's no personal relationship, right? The Torah, we started this, of course, last class, is interested, says the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, says the Ramban, and the Sefer Achinuch in the sources that we have in the beginning of the Choveret. Okay, so if you turn, the Choveret starts with page 1, right? Okay, source 1 in the Mor Nevuchim. Now these sources, all three of these sources actually, the Mor, the Ramban in the beginning of Vayikra, as well as the one page I give you from the Sefer Achinuch, are all translated, right? And they all pose the same three questions, right? The same questions is what is Kemosh Nechleku An Sheha Iyun Mivalei Hadat Ha'im Ma'asav Yitale Totsa'o Shel Chochma. Right? Rambam says that this is certainly his position, that through the development of the intellect, the human being can determine what is the best way to enhance life in this world, to enhance the meaning of life, to answer the question, why are we here? That seems to be the point of a book of Tanakh called Koheles. Does it ring a bell a little bit? Right? What are we here for? What are we doing? And full disclosure, I just gave a class in Chamesh Megillos, but the Koheles, every pasuk in Koheles can be divided between a Navi, a Chacham, an Amal, or a Nehenen. Someone who is a seer. We'll see that means the Yirei Shamayim, the God-fearing one, right? The chacham, which is moral neutral, right? Could be a chacham and not be particularly righteous. Right? I'm just completing a perish to the Haggadah where in the thesis of dividing the Haggadah into four parts based on the four sons, is that the tum is the best one of the four. The chacham is not necessarily moral. It's a tum opposite the rasha, and the chacham opposite the shenar de'elishon. Right, so the chacham not necessarily reaches the apex of what the book wants to do. He says in the book, Amarti ech kema, v'hi rechoka mimeni. I try to resolve life's problems through chokhma, but it can't. It's not going to work. Right? Okay, the amal is the striver. Maybe just keep striving more and more and more. And then the nehene, oh boy, the Epicurean, the one who just wants to enjoy life as much as possible. It's chapter 2 of Koheles, right? Tries to bring meaning to life by... But don't out and out dismiss number 4. It's a book of the Bible that suggests by giving yourself things to enjoy, you might capture some meaning. If you temper it properly, you know a famous book of Musa that's opening sentence is that. I just heard someone say, Mesilas Yesharim. Okay? Mesilas Yesharim, opening line is, now let me teach you how you will enhance the enjoyment of Hana'ah through my book of Musa. You will have a mamish Hana'ah dika life. You will enjoy life more than those guys who are, whatever. I don't even know what's at stake there. But so the Rambam says, what is it? Is there a tachlis to this thought process itself? Right. So he says, kach nechleku machlokes zu atzma b'tzviyim asher tzivolanu. We have different opinions of what the purpose of the mitzvah is. Is it to inculcate faith? Is it to inculcate obedience? Does every mitzvah, everything behind it, lead to something that's going to make me better? I don't know. Not for everybody. Maybe yes. I don't know. Okay. Taras and Mishpacha generally works very well with a young observant couple. They have some time of separation and then they're joined together and their marriage is reunited and reignited every month. Right? And Taras Mishpacha, at least the way it has come down to us with the Shev and the Kiyam, is a great enhancement of fertility, because the woman's most fertile time is when she's coming back from the mikvah. Right? You're not going out that night, you're not playing basketball that night. You're not even going to a shir that night. You're home with her. And you have flowers on the table and you're making dinner for her when she comes back from the mikvah. Right? You're going to be with her that night and the next night and the next night. Because you haven't been with her almost 2 weeks. And that's her most fertile time. Right? So the observance of Taras Mishpacha does a lot for family building, for relationship building. Wonderful. But for some couples, the observance of Taras Mishpacha does not work so well. For instance, if her time of ovulation makes it so that she can't conceive by waiting this amount of time to go to the mikvah. Right? So the Rambam is well aware of the fact that you can't just say every single mitzvah of the Torah is there to make us, every single one of us, reach our full potential. It doesn't. It doesn't necessarily work that way. That's not the point of the mitzvah. At least not, I can't say that for everybody. This is something that entered the engagements class. There was I only see one or two of you that was in that class. Two or three of them, right? Yes, you did. A couple of you were in that class. But one of the engagements topics was on homosexuality and the Torah. Right? So the Torah is quite explicit and quite unequivocal about what it feels about this topic. Right? This is not to say that someone who finds himself with this inclination is therefore damned by the Torah because of this inclination or behavior, for that matter. Lots of people don't follow every mitzvah of the Torah. It says the mitzvah of Ahavta V'Yachal Kamocha applies to that person as well as anyone else. The Rambam, what the Rambam is getting at is the whole Torah is a package. The Torah is not going to change. That was one of his tenets of faith. And the people who wanted to change by saying, well, at the time of the Torah, homosexuality was practiced just as a whim or just as a, very vigorously by Socrates, I must tell you, and all his friends. And it was a camaraderie, but today we can have a loving relationship, and we can have it's very different. And this is where the Rambam might himself balk. It's one thing if you find yourself incapable of keeping a particular mitzvah, right, because of an inclination, whatever it may be, and you try your best. Try our best to keep the other. I think the community, but this again, I'm encroaching upon the other course. This course is called Jewish Engagements in the Community, and the community has to balance, you know, how we measure this observance with, let's say, other observances, and while staying true to the flavor of the Torah, because once we start making the Torah bend to the dictates of whatever social circumstance exists, and I will admit there are some times where we do the Torah not just begrudgingly but allows polygamy, it allows slavery, right? Those are abhorrent things for us today. You'd be put under the ban if you engaged in these things. You'd be put into cherem, right? And great biblical heroes of ours engaged in these things, had slaves and had more than one wife at the same time. So what does that mean to us, right? Certainly the Torah doesn't command those things. It just begrudgingly allows them. Right? So it means having the conversation. And again, that's a different course. But what the Rambam wants from the mitzvah, so his conclusion is, and all three of these say the same thing in these assignments I gave you, is that it's one big package. Can't look at every single thing we do and say, well, I'm giving my son a bris because this is going to make him healthier, and this is going to, you know. The first reason why you're giving his son a bris is because it says so in Bereishis chapter 17. Right? Then you want to look to enhance the mitzvah. This is mostly taken up by the third source I gave you here. It's the Sefer HaChinuch. I'll take the questions in just a moment. I'll finish my presentation. The Sefer HaChinuch says that our Talmud, especially the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin in the second paragraph, the Talmud says that the Torah purposely does not tell us the reasons for mitzvahs, because if it gave us the reasons for mitzvahs, we'd take out our thumbs and work outside the mitzvah. Right? There are two places in the Torah where the Torah gives a reason for mitzvah. It says, don't amass too many horses, because then you'll go back to Egypt. Don't have too many wives, they'll turn your heart astray. And a very wise king said, oh, well, I'll take many horses. You have 40,000 stables of horses. I won't go back to Egypt. He did. I'll have many wives, but I won't turn my heart astray. He had many wives, and they turned his heart astray. So if Shlomo can succumb to the pitfall of working through the reason, right? If Shlomo can fall to that, how much more so would we? So the Sefer HaChinuch says, I'm not writing a book. You all know what the Sefer HaChinuch is about, right? I'm not writing a book to give you the reason for the mitzvahs so that you can darshan when to keep it, when not to keep it. The book seems to be written by a man to his... Guy, a lot of you are not tuned in. I know, because you tuned in to something else, so please. I'm not giving you the reasons for the mitzvahs so you can darshan out when they apply and when they don't. I'm giving you the reason for the mitzvahs so we can enhance your observance. Right? You probably everyone here, I mean, you're in YU, you're probably keeping kosher, right? And one of the most pronounced measures of keeping kosher is that you're not eating milk and meat, right? Okay. The majority of you in this room are not eating cheeseburgers. So if I asked you, why don't you eat milk and meat together, your answer is probably because, I don't know, I grew up with that. That was one of the first things I was told as a kid, right? It wasn't negotiable in my family. We never put milk and meat in the... We had two different sets of dishes, two different sets of silverware, we had two different dishwashers, we had two different sinks. I knew it from my... But you know what, when I think of it, I don't know why. It's just part of what I do, right? So Sefer HaChinuch says, you're fine. You're doing okay. You're a good firm Jew. But I want to enhance what milk and meat means to you. Right? Not that you should draw the conclusion afterwards that says, well, then that, if that's what it is, then I'll do X, Y, and Z, because, all right? because there's sort of two parts to every mitzvah. There's a mathematical side, which is just the nitty-gritty, the details, the shiurim, 160, if it's in, right, your day of... But there's also an aesthetic side to every mitzvah. The aesthetic is, how is this touching me? How is this changing me? How is this making me to be back to what we're saying in this introductory phase of the course, to perfect the individual? How is it doing that? And the Sefer HaChinuch claims that if you know what's behind the mitzvah, it'll make you better. It'll do better for you. You can't be enjoying this that much. Come on. Alright? All right, so here is what the Sefer HaChinuch says. Milk represents the life of an animal, right? First day of every animal, a human's life, you need to drink milk, or you're going to die, right? The milk represents the lifeblood of an animal. The meat of an animal that you eat represents its death, right? It's dead now, that's why you're eating its meat, okay? The Torah does not want you to mix those two together. It's why you're not supposed to drink blood either. Right? It's why you're not supposed to slaughter the mother and the young on the same day, nor to take the bird, the mother bird, the eggs in front of the mother bird. The Torah tells you, if I'm going to let you eat animals, something I didn't actually allow to Adam and Eve, right? Remember that? I didn't allow Adam and Eve to eat animals. I told them herbs. I only allowed Noah, after he saved them, to eat them. Right? But I'll begrudgingly allow you to eat animals, but it's very, very specialized. You've got to do a lot of things before you eat animals. Not least of which is shechita, which is very complicated. Not everyone can do it, right? All right. There's many more things that make it possible that they make it kosher. Very few of the animals on planet Earth actually can be eaten by you, right? And then once you get that meat in front of you, you've got to be clear of how you eat it. Right? Did you just have? Are you having dairy? Did you have anything with dairy? Did you get rid of the blood? Did you get rid of the chalev? There's all kinds of things you got to worry about. Did you get rid of the gira noshe? Right. So I begrudgingly allow you to eat these two, to eat parts of animals, but do not toast its death with its life. It is cruel to eat milk and meat together. This is what the Rambam says in the Mormon book. Can we have a quick question?
Yes, you're saying like.
Okay, so that's an important point that you're injecting into this, is that there is no prohibition of the Torah to eat dairy after meat. It's a drabon. The only prohibition of the Torah is to eat them together and cook together. Bologna and cheese sandwich that's just placed one on top of the other does not violate the Torah until you melt them together.
Right.
So the answer is that the rabbi's job, which started the day Moshe died, right, is to build a fence around the Torah.
So then, why do people generally wait longer to eat?
Because Talmud's conclusion is that the best way for the rabbis to put a fence around the Torah of not eating a cheeseburger, which is melted together, is to even avoid eating them from the time of one meal to the next. So if you live in Germany, where an 80-year-old German will tell you when he went to school, his parents gave him three sandwiches, one for 10 o'clock, one for 12 o'clock, one for 2 o'clock. Sandwiches. They had meals. In Germany, they ate every 2 or 3 hours. Small meals. They say that that's actually a good way to lose weight and to just eat a little bit every 2 hours. Not three big meals a day, but a little bit. That's how they ate in Germany. So in Germany, the time to wait from meat to milk was 3 hours. So I'd say 2.5 hours, 3 hours, right? Some other places where they ate even more often, the wait was less than that. The common wait, says Rashi in the Gemara in Chulin, and the Beis Yosef, so the Sfarim follow that, is to wait 6 hours, because the Gemara Pesachim says that your meal is at 12 and your meal is at 6. So that's where the 6 hours are, right? The protection of the rabbis from what would violate the Torah, got it, was considered different customs, which is all legitimate. So the Sefer HaChinuch says that I'm here to give you the explanation of the mitzvah. This particular explanation is the Rambam's explanation, in order to enhance the mitzvah on your part. Okay? Let it mean more to you. Okay? Now, all of this is clear. The Rambam refers to two ancient cultures that actually ate milk and meat together, or the Nabataeans and Sabians that ate milk and meat together in order to show this dominance. There are two studies in the 20th century, one as early as 1928, that found references to this kind of ritual in a place called Ras Shamra, and a 1985 study at Harvard by a man named Zuckerman, who also claimed to have found a representation of dafka, a goat, to slaughter a goat and then cook it in its mother's milk for this purpose. I'll just tell you that I need this in order to know that I observe this particular rule. But every time you take out a milchik dish because you're having cottage cheese, and you take out a different dish because you're having chicken, is that you're making a subconscious, maybe now a conscious, because now you know it, but a conscious decision, a conscious movement to say, only God, you are the author of life and death. I am not. I appreciate what you've given me. I take every day is a gift, and I'm going to follow your rules. Now, I'm going to follow it whether I knew this or not, but this is why the Sefer HaChinuch writes his book, to enhance your being. And now, I must tell you that all of what I just told you was once put together by a conservative rabbi some 40 years ago to say why he is all for eating cheeseburgers now. He says that we like the scholarship, we agree with the scholarship, but he wrote that since nobody is doing this anymore, we can basically have our cake and eat it too. We can believe that God is the only source of life and death. We can believe fully that in a system where there is a deity, where we shouldn't take advantage and enslave others and impose our will on others because life and death is a gift, and etc., etc. But since nobody is doing this anymore today, why shouldn't I be able to eat the cheeseburger? For you to articulate a good answer for this will take you a long way into you're in a modern world, you'll probably at some point be asked to articulate this difference. A lot of the things we do stems from the Torah wasn't given in a vacuum, but the milieu, the cultural milieu of the time of the Torah. And there are those who feel that the only thing we need to do today is what still speaks to us today. Right? If it doesn't speak to us, then don't get bogged down in these ritualistic issues. Right? So how does the Orthodox person respond to that? Orthodox meaning the one who believes in a true doctrine, doctrine that is everlasting, that doesn't change. If I may give it a drash, you've heard of the saying, you should be koveya itim la Torah. You've heard of that? Are you koveya itim? You've heard, right? Koveya itim la Torah means, do you establish the times, the cultural milieu, please pay attention, to the Torah as opposed to the opposite? Or do you impose the Torah upon the cultural milieu of the time? Right? Rather, we should say, let me, whatever faces me out there, however I respond to, let's say, the issues we just raised about diet, homosexuality, whatever it is, the married life, whatever it might be, the way I understand this is framed by my understanding of the Torah. If a parent complains to me this has happened actually exactly as this, that their child is not acting properly to them. I didn't even know where the child is, but you just opened up and said, this is what they're doing, and what should I do? So I said, you know, it's not a question of is the child acting properly to you. The halacha is that the child is required to do, you know, we're commanded. You're commanded to honor your parents, even when it's inconvenient. All right, so I gave her advice of how to deal with that, but by that age, it was probably too late. But So we frame whatever it is, how we behave with our parents, our grandparents, whatever it is, we relate to this from that's our introduction. The policy is how the hospital wants this bed, right? They claim that the person is beyond being saved. There's no quality of life. Give us the bed. There's a younger person that needs this bed. And I'm also putting some papers in front of you about using their limbs. They still have a lung and they still have a heart that can be used by someone else. Come on, this makes sense. Right? But if you approach these things from the standpoint that this person is still B'Tselem Elokim, and if the person is not halachically dead, and I'll admit that there are different opinions about what that means even, right? Is it respiration? Is it... If you were in my other class, this came up a few, you know, different things. Is it organ donation? Although organ donation is a topic in this class. Is this person halakhically dead or not? You can't kill someone to get his lungs for someone else. I must tell you, personal experience. My mother once had a debilitating reaction to a medication. It said on the bottle, don't take this if you're on high blood pressure medicine. And she was. So it was really malpractice. So we never went after the guy. But she really had a debilitating event. And they were already giving us those papers about using her limbs. Right? She lived 20 years after that. 20 more years. She was 65, she lived to be 85. But they were already telling us on that day. I remember getting dressed. I was teaching here already. Getting dressed the next day with a suit saying, okay, I'll decree on this suit today. So she lived 20 years after that. All right. So because we framed our response, it is, no, she's not dead. All right. But they were so sure. Right. So that's how we frame our responses to these things from the standpoint of, you know, what's the mitzvah? What does the halacha have to say about this? Are there some places where the halacha doesn't have anything to say? I'm going to tell you, there's a beautiful, beautiful story. You're going to love this story. Have you ever heard of the name C. Everett Koop? C. Everett Koop, K-O-O-P. He was the Attorney General of the United States in the 1980s. Right? For 8 years, 1980 to 1988, he was the Attorney General of the United States. And before he became the Attorney General of the entire country, he was the Attorney General, I think, of Philadelphia, of Pennsylvania. And there was a family that had a Siamese twins. Right? You know what that is? Where the two babies are born interconnected, but in a place where they're both breathing, they both have heads, and they both lived outside their mother for a short time. Their life expectancy was not more than a year as they were, and the case came to C. Everett Koop, who was the Surgeon General of Pennsylvania. And the case came before him that the time their life expectancy was up, and what can be done? Can you kill one to save the other? Okay. So the case came to him, and he stopped everything. He said, I can't decide myself. I heard that there is an old rabbi in the Lower East Side, and he'll have the answer of what we should do. It was Rav Moshe Feinstein, who holed himself up for about 2 weeks looking at all the makoros. When I heard this story the first time, you can look it up if you want in the Philadelphia Inquirer. They made a whole Sunday piece on this, many pages about the whole case and how Dr. Koop refused to give it an answer of what should be done until Rav Moshe Feinstein decides what is the Torah way of doing this. What does Jewish law say about this? Because Jewish law had something to say about this 1,500 years before anyone else was writing these kind of law codes. The answer to this question is in the Gemara. And so, you know, little old me, I think I knew the conclusion and I had it, I got it right the first time I heard it. Of course, this is what you should do. But it wasn't so obvious that situation presented itself. The answer is, you have to look at which one of those two is possibly threatening the other, which one is more likely to survive alone. Right? They share the liver. One is going to get it. The other one is going to die as soon as you separate them. Right? So, the Moshe Paskin, he said that one, it looks to me like that one's a rodef. That one is threatening the life of the other. I'm sorry, that's what has to happen. They separated the babies. The one died immediately. The other died shortly after. More than the year that they were given, but either another 3 months. But the Kiddush Hashem is that C. Everett Koop considered that, you know, there's a system of law before any anything else ever came to light. What do you have 2,000 years ago? Someone writing the laws of Rodef and who's threatening another life. And Mara has cases where someone's searching and the baby starts to cry. Can you muffle the baby in order to save the life of the people who are around, whose hideaway is going to be divulged and revealed because the baby keeps crying? So these are moral questions that the Gemara asks. So this whole point of this introductory phase is just to show that the Rambam, and as well as the Sefer HaChinuch define these issues. I just want to conclude this discussion with the two terminologies I mentioned before: mathematical and aesthetic. The Rav coined these two terms. Mathematical means that your observance is dry. It's given to a chart. What's a mathematical example of a mitzvah? Is that at the Seder you want to make sure that you're eating enough matzah, so you put your matzah on top of a little page that says you cover this box with matzah, and now you've eaten the kazayas, right? So that's mathematical. You know, am I blowing enough kios? Am I blowing enough truos? Is the trua last as long as it should? The reason why I called it this is because the answer to these questions is often a number, a shear, or something like that, right? But there's also an aesthetic model. What is this shofar doing to me? How is this moving me? How am I a better person because I just took out a milchik dish? Does it become something that changes me, or does it become, remember Yeshayahu's terminology, mitzvah sanoshim milimuda? I'm just doing it out of rote. I'm doing it because that's what I'm used to doing. Don't get me wrong, rote is also a good thing. That you just naturally do it, right? I give you the example last class with the kid who grows up in a home where he knows milchiks and fleishiks is not negotiable, right? They'll live with that, okay? They won't have a tantrum with that, right? As long as they're used to it and they don't see hypocrisy. Okay, So that is the Rambam, Ramban, and the Chinuch. Yes. So here's the thing: the Sefer HaChinuch has a list of the 613 mitzvahs, and it's exactly the Rambam's list. So he definitely, the Ramban wrote a book on the Rambam's list and disagreed with many of his mitzvahs. Okay, between the two of them, you have almost 700 mitzvahs. Right. But they each have 613. Because sometimes they count like Lecha Mekoli B'Charmel, Lo Tochlu Adetzem Yom Hazeh. Rambam counts three mitzvahs, the Rambam counts one. Right? One counts all of Kodshim, all the Korbanos as one mitzvah. One counts, no, Chatas is a mitzvah, Ashem is a mitzvah, Ola is a mitzvah, right? Each one is a separate mitzvah. Right? Besides these two, there's a smog that holds that all the women you're not supposed to marry, that's one mitzvah. Don't marry any of these, one mitzvah. The other ones, what are you talking about? Don't marry your aunt, one mitzvah. Don't marry your sister, one mitzvah. Don't marry your daughter, one mitzvah. There's many different mitzvahs there. It's all one mitzvah. But what these all have, if you added up all of the collectors of 613 mitzvahs, you're getting up to almost 800 mitzvahs. This question, what's called a mitzvah in the Torah? Right? They're all doraisas, but what gets you to the number 613? That's an amazing thing that everybody agrees that there has to be 613. Right, but so here's what I'm saying, is that the Sefer HaChinuch himself, however, was a student of the Rambam. Okay, so his list is exactly the Rambam's list, not the Ramban's objections. His philosophies, however, are more like the Ramban. All right, so what I just told you about enhancement of the mitzvah is more like Ramban. Okay, the reason why I could have taken this what we're doing here in the Schoveret from a number of places in the Ramban. I took it from the beginning of Vayikra. I took it specifically from the beginning of Vayikra for the following reason. We'll just close with this. Is that the Rambam says in a few places in the Mor Nebuchim that Kodshim, this is very controversial, at least in its time, that Kodshim, all the sacrifices that we bring in Sefer Vayikra, it's all B'diyah. It's B'diyah. It's not, God does not want to give us kodshim. God says, what do I, come on, the Goyim think they're feeding their gods with their sacrifices. They think they're drinking, they're giving them drink with their libations. I don't eat, I don't drink. There are psukim in Tanakh that say so. Look at Tehillim chapter 40, look at Tehillim chapter 50, right? You'll see there's the prophet in Tehillim that talk about, I'm not hungry, I don't get hungry. If I did get hungry, I wouldn't ask you for meat and wine, right? And they're out of law, you know, so they're mine anyway. These animals are mine. What are you giving me? Right? So the Rambam says, why did we get Kabbalists in the first place? So he says, because we couldn't fathom, get this, we couldn't fathom organized religion without it. He writes, he says, just like today, what do we need from religion? Well, we have festivals, we have eating, we have feasts. Right, we have fast days, we have prayer, we have rituals, right? We don't wake up in the morning pining for animal sacrifice, but at that time they did. They couldn't even imagine religion without animal sacrifice. So God begrudgingly gave it to them. And he said, you want a Mishkan? You have to have a Mishkan? Now, there are Maimre Chazal that echo this. Medrash Tanchuma and Parshas Truma, the Bnei Israel said, God, we want a sanctuary to offer you sacrifices, just like the Egyptians and the Sumerians and the Babylonians, they all have it. So why should we serve you with less of a fervor, with less of a ritualistic tendency than those nations? So God says, I'll tell you why. They think they're feeding their gods. I don't need that. I don't want it. They said, no, we insist. So God says, listen, their sanctuaries, their places of worship are dens of iniquity, of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shfichus Damim. They knew how to get young people to the temples. Their temples were filled with every kind of Gilui Arayos that would make you blush today. Right? Much worse than anything you could imagine on anywhere. Right? Everything was Gilui Arayos. That's how they got people to come to their worship. Right? I don't want my temple to become like that. So if you want a sanctuary like they have, I'm going to restrict what you do there tremendously. Right? Who can work there, what to do there, any infraction of the rules I make in that place, ask Nadav and Avihu what happens. Right? It's all over the Parshas Truma Tzavik, he says, and in Lo Chayav, if you don't have enough the Ketores ingredients, Chayav Misa. You didn't wash your hands, Velo Yamusin. So, you want it? You still want it? Right? Because I don't want my temple devolving into what Baal Peor does. Right? Which basically is, try to just be as outrageous as you can before your God. Just to show, I'm a human and I could do what I want. With your permission, God. My God, right? So God tells them, I don't want it to turn to that. So that's the Rambam. Ramban, in the beginning of Vayikra, your second reading, says that Korbanos is maybe something we don't understand, but I think it's lechatchila. You should be up there as taking the animal's place. You should be on the Mizbeach. You should be burning and your blood spilled and your fat poured on the Mizbeach. But God allows an animal to take your place. It's not barbaric. The Kohanim will eat that animal. This is your way to support the religious people in amongst the nation, right? So that is, so Ramban says, even when we don't understand, right? The Rambam was very sensitive to fit the mitzvahs I just said you shouldn't do this, right? The Rambam just felt, and by the way, he never writes this in the Mishnah Torah. He only writes it in the Mor Nevuchim. Okay, the Mor Nevuchim was written for Nevuchim. The word appears in this parsha. Nevuchim haim ba'aretz sagara le'amamibar. That's what Paro ran after us into the desert. Right? It was written for Nevuchim. People who feel enclosed in by the cultural milieu of their day. So I need the Rambam to help me out. I don't like Korbanos, so all right, I have the Rambam. Ramban says no. If God inherently didn't like Korbanos, who should he have told that to? Cain and Hevel. And Noah too. Alright? Just tell him, Cain and Hevel, I appreciate your giving, I appreciate what you're doing, but I don't go for this. Don't do this again. Alright? Okay, so Ramban tends to be a little more of the traditionalist,
on this issue, and this, and just the Sefer HaChinuch uses the Ramban philosophically more, uses the Rambam's list more. Okay? All right, now, you see on the introduction in the syllabus, there is Eva and Darkei Shalom, you see that? Mishnah Gittin, chapter 4. You see this? Okay? So this is what I'd like you to do. Eva and Darkei Shalom are two reasons why the Talmud says we should do certain things. Obviously, they refer to non-Jews. I think Eva and Darkei Shalom today refers to non-from Jews also. What does it mean? That we frame our behavior sometimes not because of what the halacha requires of us, but to maintain a certain aura of peace. Eva means I'm afraid, fear. If any of you attended Daf Yomi Shir, Tosfos was all over the first parak in the Maseches Avodah Zarah. It talks about things that we have to change from Talmudic times because of the Eva with which we live in our daily lives with the Christians in the 12th, 11th, 12th, 13th century. Right? Okay? One time they say that Louis Finkelstein, he taught at JTS, but he was always an observant Jew. He was once sitting in a restaurant, and a Gentile walks over to him and says, would you violate your Shabbos to save my life? Right? Would you be Mechal Shabbos to save my life? And Finkelstein answered, absolutely, 100%. And he goes, are you just saying that because of Darkei Shalom? Right? This Gentile was, I think, also taught at JTS or something in the history department, and he was aware of the Shalom's. Except, are you telling me that because of Darkei Shalom? He goes, no. I would absolutely save your life and violate my Shabbos. So he walked away, and he told the students who were with him, he told him, I said that to him because of Darkei Shalom. Right? But the fact is, what difference does it make why you're saving his life? You're saving his life. Right? Eva, Darkei Shalom. In other words, until this last minute, I've been telling you about the ideal for how we frame a Jewish public policy to perfect the individual. The individual personality, right? Now, we just injected into the discussion two words, Eva and Darkei Shalom, and I'm asking you to, for Tuesday, just look up those six Mishnayos. Look up the cases in these six Mishnayos. Chapter 4 of Maseches Gittin, if you don't have this, take one. All right? Chapter 4 of Maseches Gittin. Right there. Mishnah Aleph to Hey, chapter 4, Mishnah 1 through 6. And it'll give you a number of cases. Some of them you might not really get or may not register, but some are really quite interesting. Right? If you're held captive together with other Jews, right? You're kidnapped. And you have a 2-minute opening to escape. Are you allowed to? So the Mishnah says, "Mitushum Darkei Shalom, don't." Because what's going to happen if you escape? They might mistreat the others as a result of your escape, right? So we'll see. It's about those things. And then the next Mishnah says, "Don't overpay for ransom." Because if you overpay for ransom, they're going to see, "Oh, we can make a lot of money kidnapping Jews." Right? Remember a very famous rabbi who died in jail, and then he ordered his family not to remove him from jail if that costs money? 14 years, his bones rotted in jail. Because the Christians wouldn't let me bury it until the decree was rescinded. We're talking about the great Rishonim, the Maharam Rutenberg, the Rebbe of the Rosh, the Rebbe of the Mordechai, was one of the greatest Rishonim, the Maharam. He died in jail because of Darkei Shalom. All right, so again, this is a new theme. We're framing how we create public policy, not because the Torah says this, but because I'm worried about what the Goyim may think or some other issue. Okay, just read those six Mishnayos. Very simple assignment. Read the six Mishnayos. Come to class having read them. There's plenty of Mishnah in English. You can't tell me that I don't know Hebrew or whatever. Just get it, read it, and join.